sitting on. You know, you see something that's flat, you've got something on the back, you've got some base on it, you know it's a chair. You don't have to spend a lot of mental cycles thinking about what to do with a chair. The schema of a chair is activated even though chairs look quite differently. So in many ways, what's interesting is that we also have schemas about human beings and the different categories. And I want to focus on racial categories, although a lot of this can be done on gender and other kinds of categories. Within the actual literature, especially in critical race theory, you hear like a mantra over and over again that race is a social construction. Race is a social construction. On the one hand, that's obviously true. On the other hand, it becomes increasingly banal. A hammer is a social construction. Society did make it, and you could hit someone as a member of society with a hammer. It doesn't make necessarily our analysis clearer to say that race is a social construction. So in a schematic model, it actually gives a little bit more focus. The idea is this. In this model, you have a human being, an individual like me. You apply rules of racial mapping rules, to identify this body with a particular racial category. After you actually apply those rules to put me into a category, say Asian, if you're a little bit older, you might use Oriental, maybe Korean, other kinds of words. After you actually put the person into the category, the idea is that a particular set of meanings are automatically activated. Those meanings can be affective, just kind of evaluative, plus or minus, approach or avoid, like, dislike. Or they could actually deal with particular falsifiable truth statements like stereotypes. I bet he did well on the math SAT. I bet he does martial arts. I bet he knows how to play the violin. Two out of those three things are true. It alters the interaction with the individual, and this all happens automatically. This is an entirely simplistic model of schematic thinking about how categories help us process, but I think it's useful. When I think of race being a social construction, I mean to say that every single blue oval is meaningfully socially constructed. The mapping rules, which are oftentimes culturally sensitive, so it's basically visual morphology. So you heard my last name, you see me, you don't have specific information about my ancestry, but applying the cultural mapping rules that exist, you actually put me into the category of Asian. The categories themselves are constantly changing, right? At one time, Pacific Islanders were included with Asians. Now they've been broken off to be included with American Indians and indigenous peoples. You know, we include Pakistan into the umbrella Asian America, but we dare not include Afghanistan, but they're right next to each other. All kinds of questions about how we actually create these categories. And certainly the meanings are different. Again, at some times the meanings are good or bad, and it also might be tightly gendered in lots of ways. It might be, for example, your affective reaction is, I like that look or I don't like that look. I would like that look if he were a she, but he's a he, so I'm not into it. So there are all kinds of things that are automatically activated, and what I want to suggest is that society, culture, history has a big impact on each of these blue ovals when we talk about racial constructions. So with that simple model, where do we go from here? The question is, and I've talked about automaticity, the real question is, right, is racial meanings. I want to know what kinds of baggage is in our head, because if this cycle happens and there's automatic activation of particular racial meanings, we want to know what's in our heads about it. The problem is that there's a willingness and able problem to find out what the racial meanings are. We could ask people, well, what do you think about this category Asian? What do you think about this category female? The problem with that is that people might not want to say it because they'll be hammered by the PC police. So it's impression management. It might also be that you actually lack introspective access to the stuff that's in your head. And there's lots of reasons to think there are implicit memories and other kinds of implicit cognitive processes that we do not have fully conscious automatic control, fully conscious explicit deliberative control over. So if there's this problem of opacity, and if after the civil rights movement, after we won the civil rights movement, if you look at explicit self-reports on some of this information, the bias readings go down to zero. People do think that we should all be more or less colorblind, should treat each other fair and square, that girls should have as much opportunities to excel in science and math as boys. So if you want to tap into it, how can you actually find out what's in our heads if you don't entirely trust self-reports? There have been a couple strategies, but maybe the best one is, well, don't ask them, just measure. So you could imagine, right, in some science fiction world where you had a technology where you just put someone under some sort of instrument, and you get a reading, 76. And that tells you, on some scale, what kinds of associations or baggage or stereotypes or attitudes they have towards any particular category. We don't live in that world by any stretch, but there is a lot of interesting work that was done by you know, they'll start off by people who did affective priming, like Russ Fazio, I think at Ohio State. I think he's here. The idea here is to measure speed. So of all things, I'm going to talk about the implicit association test. They ask you to play essentially a video game. Your flashed images, I'm going to talk about this state-of-the-art instrument, your flashed images in front of a computer, a black face or a white face. You're told, if you see a black face, hit a key with this hand. If you see a white face, hit a key with this hand. You're then shown good words or bad words. If you are shown a bad word, hit a key with this hand. If you are shown a good word, hit a key with this hand. The pairing I gave you is schema consistent. Black face, bad word, same hand. White face, good word, same hand. We fly through that test. Switch. Black face, good word. White face, bad word. We stutter a little bit. There's a slight difference in the reaction speeds that we have. We're not idiots. We're talking about on the order of 300 milliseconds, maybe, in terms of the magnitude effect. But it turns out there seems to be some difference. You could do this with flowers and insects. You could do this with old people and young people. You could do this with Germans and Turks. You could do this with USC. UCLA. You could do this with Ohio State and Michigan. And you'll see these effects. So you'll see actually time latency differences on these tests. And it's pervasive in lots of ways. And so the pervasive implicit bias is remarkable. So if you want, I'll just show you a little bit of data, and we can talk more about it. This is data that Tony Greenwald accumulated with Brian Nozick and Majin Banaji off of an internet website. And the data is way too much to parse, but here's the idea. This column actually gives us explicit self-reports. These columns give us the IAT score. So if you think about the preference between, the attitudinal preference between African Americans and European Americans, if you ask them to write down an answer on an explicit survey, it turns out there's about 20% preference in favor of whites in terms of the attitudes they're shown. So like 12% are pro-African American, 32% are pro-European American, 60% are neutral on explicit self-reports. There's a 20% advantage for European Americans over African Americans. But on the implicit bias tests, again, defined as these IAT scores, you actually see it jumping up substantially to 57%. So what you find is pervasive evidence that there are these reaction time differences that basically prefer superordinate groups above and better than subordinate groups. And it happens across the board in lots of ways. So the data are actually just what I'm saying, just in terms of the reaction time differences, are substantial and across the board and really interesting. And the thing that I want to emphasize is that there is this thing called dissociation. Your explicit self-reports may not really track very well with your implicit bias readings, right? They're not exactly the same things, and you might have different interpretations of what that might mean and why that might be true. I want to have very explicit cautions, and I'll talk more about that later, but I'll have to go pretty schematically. The cautions include, reaction time differences don't mean sort of a Bull Connor racism. The idea is not, and I would rather have you pick up a model of either environmental pollution and or hypertension or something else that's less sort of hot button. By no means am I suggesting that somehow if you actually score high on these that somehow you are, you know, a Klansman that you don't know it, right? You have actually a hood inside your brain and you're just waiting to put it on. This is really important. I want to really explicitly make this clear. That's not my claim. That's not been the claim of the scientists that I've worked with. Many of them have admitted publicly, given the actual scores of their own test results, saying that I, too, show implicit bias. And that's not my claim, that this means that you're an evil person or there ought to be specific legal consequences from scoring badly on this test. More later. Well, you know, so what? You play a video game differently. You might as well say, well, someone's better at playing Halo or whatever, Gears of War or whatever the other video games are. It's not that big of a deal because you know what? When I treat people, I always treat them fair and square. When I have to decide what their employment context is, whether I have to hire them, whether I have to give them tenure, I've got all this data. I'm spending hours in these darn meetings talking it over at promotion and tenure. All these things are going on. The fact that you have 200, 300 millisecond differences can't possibly have any consequence on anything we care about. Milliseconds don't matter. So you have to actually do predictive validity studies and try to figure out if there are consequences. I want to suggest that there are consequences and actually increasing evidence of consequences, behavioral manifestations that are correlated with this thing called implicit bias. I'll talk about a couple of them, and again, we can go back and forth on the details. So McConnell and Liebold in 2001 do the best study about body language. So the basic idea is this. You have people run IATs, say the black-white attitudinal IAT. Then you run these participants into interactions with both white and black Confederates. And you have blind coding of the social interactions to see how awkward the interactions are. And social psychologists have a very sophisticated grammar with which to actually gauge body language. So whether I make eye contact with you, whether or not I stutter, whether or not I go like this, forward body lean, where I sit and how, all of those things can be coded in pretty interesting and useful ways to decide what the nature of the body, what the body language looks like. Here are the results. Interestingly enough, at least in this study, the results are that if you actually look at the data, you find correlations between the IAT and the interaction ratings, for example, and this is just these are just correlations. I guess I don't want to swarm you with detail. The basic idea is the higher the IAT, the more awkward the body language is to you. So if I have a high IAT bias against African Americans, in my interactions with African Americans, I'm going to show more awkward body language. There's very good stuff in social cognition that shows that if I'm awkward to you, you'll be awkward back to me. And then the interview ends on the merits, as being a bad interview, and I don't see the click, the chemistry, the little spark that I'm looking for someone that I want to be my colleague, my friend, my mentee. And even if you think this is not that big of an effect, you just have to aggregate that over time, over all social interactions. Think about what that does to business, whether you can sell and close a deal, whether you can be a leader, what happens on this side of the classroom versus that side, all the things that might happen in every single interaction that you experience. There's more. Interpreting. How is it that perceivers actually interpret targets? In one study by Rudman and Glick in 2001, she finds what is called an agentic backlash against women. The idea is that in particular job conditions that require you to be androgynous, in the sense that you have to be highly agentic and capable, and you also have to be a good people person, that's what they mean by the androgynous job condition, women who were deemed agentic were rated worse in social skills than men who were exactly the same in terms of their agentic traits. And this was correlated with a gender IAT that affixed, that kind of associated gender categories with work or kind of support and family. So I'm going too fast to give you any of the details, but I'm suggesting I can get into more of the details and the effect sizes and whatnot. But the basic idea is, at least in this study, how evaluators, right, decided whether or not this person was hireable or not turned, at least were correlated with the gender IAT scores that they had found. And for certain women, there was a hit. There's some evidence that it also affects shooting, of all things. So Joshua Correll in 2002 did this great study where he literally made it a video game. So the rule was, if you see a gun, this is a white male holding a gun, you have to shoot by clicking a key. On the other hand, if you don't see a gun, you're not supposed to shoot. So there were white males and black males. And there was time pressure put on to see who to force you to commit errors, and what you find is more false alarms with blacks, i.e., even when the African American did not have a gun, we shot, and more misses with whites. Even though the white had a gun, we did not choose. Using signal detection theory, they actually decided that it was really just a lower threshold that we had to shoot blacks. What's more disconcerting, it turned out African American players had the exact same shooter bias, so it's not just white folks only. Black folks had it as well. And in subsequent studies, people have really suggested that what's driving this is not negative attitude toward African Americans, but actually a stereotype effect that links guns to black male faces. So certainly, in the case of Amadou Diallo, who was shot at over 40 times in a dark hallway, milliseconds do matter. This was not an IAT test, but we can talk more about the connections between this kind of work and the implicit bias work that I've been talking about. Long story short, and again, I realize I don't have that much time to sketch out the argument, there's science that says we have a new instrument to measure people. It's based on reaction times. There's increasing evidence that those reaction times, although we're not quite sure what they are in terms of a theoretical construct, have consequences in the real world. They not only have consequences in the real world, they have consequences that we actually might care about from a legal perspective. And what might we do with that if the evidence gets increasingly better? So we are in many ways at a preliminary stage to think about as the evidence gets better and perhaps worse, if it does get better and we find out there are these implicit cognitive processes that we can now measure quantitatively that give these low-level R correlations but still predictable R correlations with actual behavioral manifestations, what can the law possibly do about it? This is where we introduce a school of thought that we're calling behavioral realism. I'll just give the method and not talk about how we picked the name. The idea is this. The law always has naive psychological theories about human decision-making and human behavior. What we want to do is identify latent processes or latent assumptions within the law about human decision making. Step number two is to assess new scientific understandings of human behavior, I guess especially from the mind sciences. So if the mind sciences actually give us a new description or model of how human beings think, that's great. So let's suppose we reach a new consensus 15 years from now, that suggests that the way we think is really different and the new instruments tell us interesting things about that. We have to explore the implications of any discontinuity that we find from the latent assumptions of naive psychology within the law and the new consensus findings. This is in some ways a trivial point. We have to force the law to take account. The law can do so in two ways. It could either incorporate the new and improved, more accurate model of human decision making, or in the alternative, and all we ask for is transparency. The alternative is, the law can say, we can't do that. We can't do that for religious reasons. We can't do that for prudential reasons. We can't do that for pragmatic reasons. We can't do that for political. You know, whatever the reasons are, just be straight up on it and not actually deceive us about the state of human behavior. This is the method of behavioral realism. Note that it is agnostic to which particular set of sciences you're emphasizing. If you want to go, quote, right wing, if it turns out evolutionary psychology findings are really associated tightly with a right-wing politics, but you think that that's, in fact, the right kinds of science, right, and that's what science tells us, this is completely neutral to the actual content of the scientific findings, right? It is derivative to the idea that through scientific orthodoxy we can gain a new consensus, but if that consensus is pleasant to you, not pleasant to you, it doesn't matter. That's not what we're saying. But whatever that consensus is, we ought to incorporate into the law or have the law tell us otherwise. And that's what the project is right now. And there's been an aggressive project in this. I guess there are examples, right? So in many ways, at least with the implicit bias literature, there was an article in the Harvard Law Review in 2005, which I wrote, called Trojan Horses of Race. So it was applied to mass media policy in an article called Trojan Horses, which was in 2005. And there was a California symposium, which was out in 2006, where I, with Majrin Banaji, talk about affirmative action policy and how they might be revised in light of fair measures. And there's a movement among scholars, and if you know anything about the dominant, almost imperialistic role of rational choice theory and Chicago School neoclassical economics within the law, the pushback on that has been behavioral law and economics that have adopted heuristics and biases, psychological cognitive insights, and this is in some ways a more aggressive attack on the rational choice model, at least within the domain of social interactions. And then, of course, in the wings is evolutionary psychology, a.k.a. sociobiology, a.k.a. behavioral genetics. You know, lawyers have lots of different names for that. That's about to come in hard in different ways. So this is a really interesting time for the role and the relationship of social science generally, and the mind sciences in particular, and the law. Okay, here's where things get completely speculative. Let me predict a future path. The future path looks like this, and I hope you could actually see it. Here's the idea. So I don't play chess. I'm Asian, but I don't play chess. So I guess that probably doesn't exist as a stereotype too much. But I'm told that if you're really good at chess, you can predict 6 or 7 moves ahead in, right? And the whole point is to predict the moves in advance and see the moves early on. So here's the idea. The two columns, the diamonds, are the critical sort of paths that I follow. This is supposed to be scientific and descriptive. This is supposed to be more law and normative. Put aside the contestation of the fact-value distinction that might exist, and we could talk about it. This is simplified. So we start at the descriptive inquiry. Basic questions we have to ask. Does this thing called implicit bias really exist? This is where construct validity and other kinds of questions really come in. If yes, if it's no, we're done. we stop the scientific grounds. There's nothing interesting. It's just a mirage. We thought it exists, but implicit bias doesn't exist. But if it does exist, we have to ask, is there real-world impact? Again, if there's no real-world impact, hey, fun superstring theory. I don't really care because there's no real-world consequences on this. You might as well, you know, read literature. Real-world impact. If there is a real-world impact, then you do have to ask, well, can it be countered in some ways? And the answer might be no, you can't change it, maybe because it's hardwired, and so you have to in some ways give up, because if that's just the way we are, we can't do anything about it, we can't do anything about it. So I'm going to say those are interesting scientific questions. But what happens if yes is the answer to all three of them? We have a normative inquiry, which is one, should bias be countered to begin with? Right? We normally think of bias as being a bad thing, but maybe bias ain't so bad. There's a reason why we're afraid of spiders. Should we really try to get rid of that? If the answer is no, then we stop on normative grounds. We continue. If the answer is yes, you have to ask, well, does it respect notions of individual autonomy? Right? As these dual process models of social cognition really start pushing at the idea of ghost in the machine, if you're familiar with Daniel Wegener's work, for example, on the illusion of control, illusion of free will, you find it really, as a lawyer, if you read that stuff, it's really disturbing. The experience of free will that you have might not be very good evidence that you actually have it. You might have it, but don't credit so much the experience of free will that you actually have. And then if that's also true, then you have to ask questions about whether it's lawful. For example, if the intervention requires race-based interventions, does it satisfy the Equal Protection Clause in Title VII? Highly stylized, but you gotta allow me to do it. The orange or peach or brown or beige ovals, the beige ovals reflect what I think to be the important moves along this. So if you think it doesn't exist, you can deny it. Denial will be an important point. If you think it has no real-world impact, it's minimization. It's de-minimization, right? If you think it can't be countered, you can say it's hardwired. So you resign yourself to the existence of implicit bias. It's a resignation move. If you get to the next side, you've got a couple more. You could actually have a move of justification, that it's accuracy. This is the profiling argument. Of course we should actually subject Arab people to greater searches at the airport. It's only rational, duh, right? There's nothing wrong with it. It's a rational reflection of underlying base rates. You could reject it on autonomy grounds. You could reject it. I'm just picking the example of equality, but you could have lots of other legal claims. So what I'm saying is these beige areas are the critical moves that we will see both on the scientific discourse and the legal discourse. And I want to give them names, not try to load up the conversation too much. I try to pick kind of neutral names for it and tell me if I failed. But this is what I predict in each of these moves. So I want to talk about these moves, or at least sketch them out in the following way. So that's how I predict the path. Notice there's a descriptive inquiry and what I call a normative inquiry. We can talk about denial, and I'm just going to go through this because this is scientific questions that are really important. You could, for example, think that data are bad. There's no reliability in this test. Test retest on the IAT. The metric doesn't make any sense. Why should milliseconds matter? The fact that you're 50 milliseconds more biased than I am, does that mean you're like 3% more racist than I am? I have no idea what this metric actually means. You could say it's a bad inference from the data, even if it's good, and this raises questions about construct validity, which we'll talk about. In some ways, if you don't know the ideas of construct validity, the general point, I think, is that in some ways we have observables down here. We have more conceptual stuff up here. And what we're observing are these reaction time differences. Does that really map to this greater concept, which we can't directly observe as bias, prejudice, racism, however you want to call it? That's the really important question about construct validity. There would be minimization. Minimization could be just that the effect sizes is minor, there's very little predictive validity, and it might happen in the lab but not in the real world. Standard arguments you see all the time in the social science literature. Related, and this is coming from the rational choice defense against behavioral law and economics critiques, is that, well, we can minimize it. If you just raise accountability, raise the financial stakes, other stuff I won't talk about until later, that there are ways to easily burn this out. For example, the market will burn off discrimination because it's irrational to discriminate because you can get better human capital at lower cost and therefore outcompete. Gary Becker did this a long time ago. I want to spend most of my time talking about politicization, right? So from Denial and minimization, these two are meant to be on the merits scientific engagements, right? As heated as they are on the merits scientific engagements. This part gets the lawyers involved more aggressively, and this is the politicization. You could have over-enthusiasm from the left. I talked already about IAT effect as being equivalent to Jim Crow racism. You could have people blaming only white males, white heterosexual young males, I guess. But the idea is, and the data is very clear, that a lot of this stuff is both internalized, and you see it in every society, more or less, these kinds of differences. I don't think I'm exaggerating that much when I say at least you see the effect sizes everywhere. Some people might say, well, then it's a perfect polygraph for individual detection. Run Alito through it. Come on, do it in front of a hearing. Alito, go. And then trying to figure out what the result is for his nomination. People will say that, and you're laughing, but we do use polygraphs. We use crazy stuff like Myers-Briggs tests when we hire people all the time. We use the LSAT, for God's sakes, to let you in. And if you want to look at the R values of the LSAT, you know, where's the political mobilization against that in some sense? It might be that people just simply overclaim reformist implications. So a lot of things that are purely corrective justice claims, like we did a lot of bad stuff in the past, and they have consequences today, and we have to fix them just out of pure corrective justice grounds, those grounds oftentimes are not covered by the implicit bias arguments I make right now, and that's sort of a detailed argument that we try to clarify in our Fair Measures piece. So don't do any of these things. We're not suggesting them. People will suggest that we're suggesting them. We're not suggesting them. Backlash from the right. This is where it gets really interesting. The backlash from the right looks really similar in some sense to denial and minimization. Substantively, it's exactly the same, but it's not any longer on the merits. It's actually off the merits. This is really contested space, so I'm going to abstract out for a moment. And here's the abstraction. Imagine you were from Mars. There are two types of science in science-driven controversies. And again, I'm trying to pick names that are not loaded, but I don't know if I can. So reformist science and Tory science. So oftentimes on the leading edge, there are new findings that have strong implications for change in the social order. I'm going to call that reformist science. Then there's science that pushes back, saying, you've got to be kidding. There's no way that this reformist science is actually good. I'm going to call that Tory science. I've talked to scientists on whether people will know, scientists will know what Tory science is, and I don't know. I don't even know if law students know what the Tory might mean. There's two qualities of science. It could either be correct or mistaken under very traditional scientific orthodoxy over the long equilibrium states. We don't know now, but we could find out later. And you should just assume, unless you sort of think that there's a Kuhnian scientific paradigm shift that needs to happen, you know, we could have those conversations. It's going to be correct or mistaken. Here's where it gets provocative. There could be two sources of error. It could be banal in the way that science is always wrong. That's the whole point of doing science. It's wrong so you can push ahead. Or it could be venal, right? That you're really not driven by science. You're, in fact, driven by ideology, by political commitments, by end results. It's not judicial activism. It's scientific activism. Could happen. So to be really disinterested, here's the table, right, that of four possibilities that I'm interested in. It could be that the reformist science is, in fact, mistaken, and the Tory science is correct, and the source of the error is just banal. You just got it wrong. You weren't smart enough. It could be number two, that the reformist science is correct, the Tory science is mistaken, and that's also banal. Numbers one and two don't interest me that much. This is what science does over and over, and that's great. Three and four are interesting because three and four both make different attributions. It could be mistaken, correct, and venal. This is the allegation of junk science. You're providing junk science, and you're throwing it into the courtrooms, into the legislative fora, to get particular results for ideological purposes that have nothing to do with an honest commitment to science itself. But you have pure symmetry the other way. It might be, it ain't number three, it's number four. It's backlash. That the reformist science is correct, the mistaken science is actually the Tory science, and the science that you bring up to create and manufacture doubt has nothing to do with substantive merits. You just want to stave off regulation and any change. And you have the venal motivations. To be, again, very fair, intelligent design is number three, in my view. The claims that there's a new science of intelligent design that says that there was an omniscient maker that helped evolution along, I think is mistaken. I think the Tory science that pushes back on intelligent design is, in fact, correct. I think it's also correct to say those people who are pushing intelligent design as science have venal motivations, not in the meretricious kind of monetary way, but they're driven by a commitment to a particular set of policy results, regardless of what the science says. See, I'm being fair, right? I'm saying sometimes number three is in fact correct. Number four is the tobacco industry. Secondhand smoke causes cancer. You manufacture doubt, and you get spokespersons, usually men, right, with PhDs, who say, we don't know. I mean, there's no reason to think this. And it's just a nanny state from the EPA trying to keep you from doing your individual freedom thing. And boy, they don't care one whit about the actual science. Abstractly, we don't know whether we're in three or four. But the backlash or the junk science claim will come, and we'll have to resolve it. So there will be a complaint that everything that I've shown you and everything that I've written is junk science. Our response will be, no, no, it's backlash. And there's motivated reasoning everywhere. So how do you decide who's right, and where might you decide it? Very simple suggestions, and since I've talked for a long time, I want to try to really close down. We recommend a decoupling. We want to separate out the question of correctness of science and the allegations of venality. And we want to leverage the relative institutional competencies of the science journals and the law reviews. The science journals should ultimately decide whether or not the science is correct. Similarly, or I guess correspondingly, the law reviews should decide over the long term over the allegations of venality. I'll tell you later that life has imitated scholarship, and we're just in the process of dealing with some stuff that I think goes over the top in terms of the complaints about our work, and we can go into the details in Q&A later on. Just to sketch out the rest of the argument, because in some ways it'll be easier to understand, I do say that there will be a resignation point. If the science progresses this way, people will start actually saying, this is too much detail, people will start saying essentially that this is hardwired, and there's some scientific reasons to think why some of it is actually reflects basic aspects of our brain. And there's a standard set of responses to the claim that it's hardwired. There's reasons to think it's not hardwired, as well as other evidence of malleability. I'm just going to do this schematically and just finish, and then go back to it as we deal with question and answer. The normative inquiry will be interesting about justification and accuracy. This is the rational racism or rational profiling argument that we often hear. I do want to note that there are lots of psychological processes to make you wonder whether or not we are such good Bayesian predictors of behavior. There's lots of evidence of what we call illusory correlation. There's evidence of outgroup essentialism. Excuse me, I didn't mean to do that. Evidence of outgroup homogenization, and there's evidence of lots of errors actually being made. I'll just talk about, for example, illusory correlation. There's really great data that suggests that we actually tend to actually parse statistical data in incorrect ways. If you have particular salient groups like outgroups, like African Americans, even if they have, imagine a set of cards, right? And you have black faces or white faces, and you have crime or no crime. And you actually have the base rates be exactly the same. 25% of the whites are crime. 25% of the black faces are crime. You shuffle the deck and you give it to someone and have them look at it quickly. What they remember is they find salience connections, and they find the black face and the crime, and they actually overpredict the percentage of actual base rate, and it's not 25. You actually see disparities. So there are lots of psychologically based reasons to think that this idea that we're being accurate doesn't actually work. I think the only other thing that I want to talk about is this idea of a double standard. A lot of the people who will push back on the implicit bias science as not being sufficiently rigorous and bad science, right, demanding almost a metaphysical certitude because they're really concerned about what the social implications are, then completely forget about the possibility and don't sort of crank up the scientific rigor requirements for plausible claims that, well, no, my association with blacks and crime, it's accurate. It's rigorous. It's good enough, right? When all the evidence suggests to the contrary that we're actually very, very bad predictors of these kinds of probabilities. And then we'll talk more about, I guess, you know, there are open questions about autonomy, how to think about autonomy and about equality, but I think those are more understood moves within the law, and since I want at least some time to deal with questions for 10 minutes for people who have to leave at 1, I'll leave it at that. The conclusion I have, is just the following, right? The future of law is at stake. I really do think that the role of social science, of all the different kinds, its incorporation to the law, the very heavy turn that we've taken toward the empirical sort of methodology in sciences, for the next 20 years, this is the entire game. And this is the entire game in terms of also the political jockeying on who commands and who has pole position, what science is invoked as being dominant in thinking about these questions. So everything is at stake in the future of law. Related to this also is the idea of the left and the science. So I will be transparent about my political views and about my commitments. If you have questions, I'll answer them to as honestly as I can. But there was a time when the left gave up science, especially in race theory. There was a turn to postmodernism and narrative as the best way to get people to think about the plight of repressed peoples. And on the one hand, that's exactly true. Stories are very powerful. Ask any trial lawyer. That's what we do. We start with stories to make you think something's going on. But these days, a regression meets up with a story, and the regression wins every time. And I do not want the left to give up a commitment to science, either implicitly in terms of attitudinal reactions or explicitly in terms of a research program and or training future race scholars in the future. And finally, I want to stay relentlessly on the merits. Everything that I've discussed, everything is geared naturally for the worst kind of blog-style political attack editorial conversation because there's too much at stake. People are pissed off and defensive, right? Everything is at stake in some sense on race relations here, and I want to stay relentlessly on the merits with deep self-criticism about what it means to do that, knowing that motivated reasoning abounds.
Yeah. You don't have to get to, obviously, 1936 to, you know, really get that to be transparent. And I say it in the context, for example, of the debate over the survivor race experiment, as it were, right? That seemed to be a setting in which there was an effort to really piece a lot of this stuff out, and yet there was this extraordinary reaction, or I would say overreaction, to that experiment, and a failure in many ways to sort of use an introspection over the extent to which there are some flourishing virtues to the bond that the bias might be the precursor to.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So another way to kind of reframe that question is, what is your imagination of the perfect community or the perfect individual? Do you really, like, do you just want to get rid of these kind of, quote, irrational system two or automatic associations generally, as between Buckeyes and Wolverines, as between just anything, you know, Klee over Klimt? Do you really want to do that? And in no way am I suggesting that the ideal life or the ideal individual is necessarily Spock-like, where they're all associations must be justified. In addition, right, I'm not generally thinking about, right, in-group biases alone are expected and often not problematic. I take it as accepted that we will have in-group biases that favor your family, your kin, other kinds of stuff, oftentimes your nation state. And I'm not jumping up and down at the problem of nationalism alone, although obviously to an extreme it's a problem. So everything that I've suggested, right, relies on, right, if I want reformist movement, it relies on other normative commitments. I don't mean to suggest that it's only utilitarian that we ought to look at. I focused on this because that's my prediction. I do think, right, as a predicted set of arguments, what will come out aggressively are the utilitarian arguments, not the interesting communitarian arguments that you had provided, and that's why I focus on there. And what I do, in some ways, is deeply parasitic on the particular norms about race that we already have. We have particular norms that we almost universally accept that there ought to be, in some sense, colorblindness, that any distinction, any disparate treatment along race has to be articulated and justified, that we have natural skepticism against that. It's not always all the way down to the private sphere. Like on marriage, I think a lot of people say, look, I just don't want to touch that. If you want to marry people who look like you, I have no views on that. But at least in the public sphere, we have norms that I am fine with. And I'm using them because I'm fine with the official ideology of the United States. If it weren't the official ideology, I'd have another whole set of arguments. And then I could leverage basically a call for consistency to drive it. So it's true that you have these ideas. And
yeah.
Yeah, so it's we have a wide consensus to the extent that they remain uncomfortably fuzzy. So I think a lot of people would disagree with anti-subordination if it really guarantees equality, a certain equality of minimal primary goods in terms of actual results. A lot of people just like equality of opportunity, and so it does break down. But just this idea that people should be judged by the content of their character and not by race because it's basically race irrelevant, I think is a strongly held norm. I'm being parasitic on that. I think it's a very hard conversation about what human flourishing will look like, and I don't strong views about what the good life looks like vis-a-vis this, but obviously notions of the good life will have cultural implications, will then have implications on the implicit associations in our head. Do you want to go?
Yeah. I really like your talk, and I really like how you're trying to bring in these concepts of social psychology into law. My question has to do with really practically how can we do this in the sense that social psychology is definitely a eager young kind of field. It's probably never going to be a consensus on what truth is in that sense. IT is probably one of the most hotly debated, very passionately debated things in social psychology right now. People having a lot of arguments against this. At what point can the law then say, we are now going to make legal judgments, policy decisions? Like, how much consensus do you need?
Yeah. So a couple things that I want to that's a great question, and it's a hard question. But just to be clear, I want to frame it the right way. So a lot of people want to say, well, look, when can you bring this kind of evidence into litigation? It's not only about litigation, frankly, because the law and legal institutions make choices all the time. A voluntary affirmative action program. Like, tell me that's not exercise that you, among faculties, right, you tell me that you don't use, even if you're not in Proposition 209 land like I am, but if you're here where it's permissible to use some form of affirmative action, tell me you're not considering, if you have a fantastic woman who's actually coming on the psychology department, or tell me you're not considering her identity, right, or his race in making that decision, right? If you have an excellent person, it's a tie, tell me you're not using it. So what I'm suggesting is that we make these decisions in institutions, including law-like institutions, all the time, and it's not only about litigation. It could be administrative agency decision-making. It could be how you define the public interest under FCC practice. So it's not only litigation. That's the first point. The second point that I want to make sure, whether you call it type 1, you can think of it as type 1, type 2 error, or lawyers will call it the baseline problem, in the sense that right now, in the existing law, we have a folk wisdom about how people behave. And that folk wisdom is embarrassingly wrong in lots of ways. And yet we allow it to go day in and day out, misfiring day in and day out, and no one screams about it. Why? Is it just a status quo bias? Conspiracy theorists will say no, because it actually promotes a particular set of power and resources that the majority actually seems comfortable with. But even then, if we want to translate it in, there are ways, right? We have something like the Daubert framework on how to deal with expert testimony. And it is this kind of idea that you want something like a consensus. So I'm not an expert in evidence law, but there is, just as we've done with carcinogens, causation problems, and toxic torts and other kinds of things, there is some notion of a scientific consensus that is reached through peer review processes, a scientific orthodox. And there's a machinery to apply it, even if it's imperfect. Now, the final question is a really question about metaphysics, right? So coming from the law, I think, of course, lawyers scream at each other, But we should have on the merits, and people ought to be really kind of understand and get to consensus in science. And then as I look at this stuff, it's not that clear that scientists actually behave that much better. They don't, when they actually talk to each other, oftentimes the objections don't actually meet head on in the way that lawyers do it. We'll go out, they say argument one, two, three, A, B. On one, we say this. On two, it's these kind of opaque like paragraphs that suggest other kinds of stuff. There's a different social and epistemic practice that allows for engagements to happen in particular ways. And you might think, whether you're a realist, anti-realist, whether you believe objectivity exists or subjectivity, you might seriously question about the epistemic possibility of science to do anything different than politics. Certainly there's a postmodern critique of science. It ain't all that it's cracked up to be, folks, because the same kinds of huge political struggles get in, and most scientists I've talked to, right, are exceedingly smart, but they don't know and don't care one whit about philosophy of science and a lot of history of science. They just, it doesn't affect their day-to-day life. It surely doesn't affect whether they get tenure or not. And they just do what they do. And I don't take that as a criticism, but it's just a realistic description. So you might think science cannot reach a long-term equilibrium point any more than raw politics and power can. At which point, why would you try to rely on science to get you anything better? And the answer is, I'm actually a more optimist. I'm an optimist about science. My undergraduate degree is in physics. I thought seriously about becoming a scientist. I am actually more optimistic. And deep down, if you really ask me, in some ways, I am a true believer about the values of science and the possibilities of reaching long-run equilibriums, even though things are provisional and contested all the way on important things. And I take climatology and the global warming debate to be a useful example of it. As heated as it was, as much pushback as there was politically, in the end, at least in the past 3-4 years we've seen this, and I don't think it's only about the Inconvenient Truth PowerPoint slide turn movie. In the end, we have a consensus that, you know, human beings have had significant impact on the climate. And so that's my hope. And the metaphysics debate is resolved in a particular way that I do think, right, I do think science can produce useful consensus knowledge, and I'm willing to state that just publicly, even though a lot of my postmodern friends think I'm deluded.
Yeah. Could you provide some examples on how either the IAD specifically or implicit bias generally influences things, or would influence things like jury selection or
affirmative action? Yeah, so let me, that's great. So let me try to get a little bit more concrete. And so I'll think about it in terms of affirmative action debates, right? And some of this will sound, I'll give you one thing which sounds more policy kind of framing thing, and then one which is a very practical selection process. And so the general thing in the background is that most justifications for affirmative action have either been backward-looking or forward-looking. So why do we need affirmative action? Because we had slaves, or because it makes our tax classes better, right? The classroom actually runs better. They're backward-looking or forward-looking. We can't demonstrate enough discrimination going on right now, formal discrimination. General societal discrimination doesn't count. So if you say, but we still have racism, the answer is it doesn't matter. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. That's not a compelling interest under the current equal protection law. What implicit bias allows you to do, which doesn't get you everything, but what it allows you to do is to change the frame to a presentist framing. It's not necessarily about stuff that happened in the past. It's not about stuff that will happen in the future with questionable sort of evidence of the pedagogical benefits of diversity, which is, I think, in genuinely ways, in lots of ways, mixed. We love to jump onto it because as liberals, as a liberal, a lot of people want to jump onto the pedagogical virtues of diversity because we know backward-looking discrimination has been shut down as a justification. But in all reality, right, if you look at the real science under that stuff, it's not, you know, there's a lot of mixed stuff. What this allows for is a presentist political framing. The idea is this. Look, you think we're colorblind. In some ways, maybe we are. But here's evidence that we're not colorblind. I'm not even talking about whether there's behavioral manifestations. But if you really think you're colorblind because you want to be, here's evidence that at least in a de minimis way, you are not colorblind. So if you have better evidence of predictive validity in real-world settings, just like the tester studies, right, very powerfully show, something's still going on. Like, we treat black and white resumes different. When people go to find housing, they're still treated differently. We're holding for all the confounds. There's still something going on. Just the same way those are powerful, I think these are powerful. And if you adopt a presentist framing for what we call fair measures that counter implicit bias, you can say, I'm not talking about the past, I'm not talking about the future, I'm talking about right now. Right now we have implicit bias, and so I want to adopt processes and practices that counter implicit bias right now. And that should be a compelling interest, and I'm going to show you why it's narrowly tailored. That's uncomfortably abstract, so let me give you a specific example about what I call debiasing agents. So a lot of people in hiring faculty will adopt a role model argument. They say, well, it's great to have that colored man up there speaking, because it might well be that the few Asian students who are out there will then be able to imagine a life as a law professor who happens to be Asian. And so it is a one-to-one. There's a correspondence, right? The beneficiaries are also of my race, and it's a particular kind of psychological imagination services that I'm actually providing to the audience and being a role model for them. It turns out, however, the role model argument has been rejected by the Supreme Court. And certainly under Title VII, it doesn't seem to hold any power. Here's what a different justification based on this science might be. What if I phrased it, and not just phrased it, but genuinely believed it, instead as a debiasing agent? What if I showed you evidence, and so I'm relying on work by Dasgupta, principally. So Dasgupta and Greenwald do the history survey study that says that if you do a historical survey which highlights really positive black exemplars, your implicit bias decreases. If you see examples of MLK versus, and this is provocative, versus Malcolm X, right, you'll actually like MLK better and your attitudinal bias will decrease against African Americans. Dasgupta and Asghari do a longitudinal study where they take women and they send them to either co-ed colleges or single-sex colleges, and after going through a year of single-sex college, their average implicit bias goes down to zero. If they go to co-ed colleges, their implicit bias against women go up. They try to figure out what the campus variables are. It turns out it's just the number of women professors they had and deans they had interactions with on the change in implicit bias. So what if I said the reason why you want someone like me in front is not to give people role models, which gets Clarence Thomas into a whole... He gets very upset at the idea that only Asians could only look at Asians for role models. It's deeply offensive to him. What if I said, no, it's nothing about my being a role model for Asians. Instead, I act as a debiasing agent for the entire crowd. So I scrub away the viruses in your head vis-a-vis Asians. If you thought the relationship between Asian and law was weak or negative, and it might be different because you have both Ed Lee and Dan Takagi, who are successful teachers here in this classroom, doing it in the law school. But if you thought, I've never seen an Asian person talk this way about law. It just seems kind of odd to me. I mean, he's not teaching Chinese. He's not at the local restaurant. What's going on? If it does debias you, right? If it does debias you, and that's where the studies will have to decide, then I act as a debiasing agent. There's no longer a linkage between me and a particular racialized beneficiary. It's for the whole class. And it's not to imagine someone, improving someone's future through imagination. It's just to fight bias, right? And fighting bias has always been a compelling interest under both Title VII and equal protection. So even though you might in practice think a role model argument is identical to the debiasing agent argument, it turns out it's not. It has better legs under a legal challenge, debiasing agent, and it also raises a whole other set of problems, because if you want to hire debiasing agents, then you need to hire individuals who anchor themselves to the group, right? Because if you too quickly carve them out as sub-exemplars, it's hard to think they'll do actually this kind of reformist work within the social category. They have to anchor themselves to the group, and they have to overperform on the stereotypes that exist. So if they're viewed as not being smart, then they have to overperform on smart. So if you implicitly require folks of color to be debiasing agents, you're essentially taxing them more. You're saying your job is not only to be a great psych professor, but also to be a debiasing professor, right? At which point the person would say, like, where was that in the job description, and why is that fair? And if there's only room for one, which oftentimes is the case in practice, then that one that will be hired will actually be asked to do a particular kind of work that might be effectively a tax. So in the Fair Measures article, there are more legal-like arguments. We think that cloaking people's race oftentimes is a good thing that got a lot of the people upset at us from the left. Cloaking identity is oftentimes quite useful. Limiting the way that interviews are used, we think, is quite useful because of the way that implicit bias interactions might work. How we think about tiebreakers is also something that's loosely connected with the implicit bias literature. And there are all other practical arguments that we think have, again, some real-world consequences.
Hardwiring metaphor is interesting because it can be hardwiring in the sense of sort of genetic.
So there's really interesting stuff being done in collaboration between IoT folks and developmental folks, because they're actually creating basically a kid version of the IoT, which might really spook you out in lots of ways. I will give you some evidence about in what ways it might be associated with things that we would think to be hardwired. So there was you can call it a convergent study. So there was an example where Cunningham et al. Basically put people under the magnet and just measured their amygdala reaction after being flashed black faces. And here are what the results are. I can go into details. On the IAT, right, so here... So this is too much data. Okay, so here's the idea. So they run these white participants through an IAT, and you find, again, implicit attitudinal bias against blacks as defined by this test, right? I might as well just call them blue unicorns. So don't get so upset. I'm not saying they're raving racists, right? So it's implicit bias against blacks that we find on the IAT. If you actually then flash people with a picture that takes half a second, you see actually no difference in how the amygdala lights up at that interval, because the amygdala lights up, but the prefrontal cortex represses. And so you get no net effect. On the other hand, if you do it as a subliminal thing, where you see the black face, but you don't notice it at 30 milliseconds, you actually see the amygdala being correlated with the IAT. You never see R's this high, really, and certainly. So it's there's some correlation between the amygdala and IAT scores, and, you know, a lot of brain scientists say, yeah, amygdala fires at everything. It tells you nothing. In some sense, that's true. We do know that the amygdala is connected with negative fear conditioning as well. So there's some reason to think that there's some brain biology behind it. The one other study I want to show you that I shouldn't call it shock the monkey. It turns out, what shall I show you? So it turns out that you could, through galvanic skin response, you could be made to be afraid of things, right? So I show you a picture of a butterfly and you get shocked. And a butterfly, you sweat. So you can make people afraid of anything by just kind of conditioning them in a kind of like a Pavlovian way. What's interesting is how quickly they lose the fear. You show the butterfly, don't shock them. Show the butterfly, don't shock them. So here's what we find. Interestingly, this is Olson with Banaji and some other people. And again, there's too much data I'm showing at any given time. This is for just focus on B, racial outgroup and racial ingroup. It turns out if for racial outgroups, if you're black, then we're talking about whites. If you're white, we're talking about blacks. It turns out we acquire fear faster of outgroups, and they extinguish at a very different rate. So the racial outgroup, we quickly learn to fear, and it doesn't extinguish really fast at all. On the other hand, for in-groups, we can also acquire fear, but not at such a faster rate, and they will extinguish much more quickly. And again, I'm not giving you any what the axes mean, so this is just impressionistic. What's interesting for African Americans versus whites, this is the white data and this is the black data. So for whites, it turns out, again, they get afraid of black faces much more quickly than white faces, and the fear decays at different rates. For blacks, again, they get afraid of white people more quickly, and again, the decay rates are a little bit different. They look a little bit different, but long story short, there's some evidence to think that we have measured by skin galvanic response as well as amygdala firing, that some things are pretty kind of set. It doesn't answer your question of where it comes from, genetics or early culture. It really doesn't answer that. And there are lots of reasons to think that given the rate of human evolution and when races we conventionally understood them created, that to say that it's a genetic answer is ridiculous on all kinds of levels, because the principal concern is the racial meaning. And there was a time, for example, when my face was the paradigm of the illegal immigration problem at the end of the 19th century. So we were considered vermin rats. I'm not Chinese, but you would have seen me, thought of me as Chinese. So we're vermin immigrants that come in doing nasty things, disease vectors, all of those things. That's not how we think about it now. And, you know, natural selection doesn't happen on the order of 100 years. So there are lots of reasons to think that some of it is culture, but we really don't know. We don't know. And it raises really strong questions. You know, to the extent that it becomes early culture, then obviously people are going to want to intervene in culture. And then people are going to raise the autonomy question. How dare you mess with the mind of my young child? But then I have to ask you the baseline question. What the hell is Barney? What is Sesame Street? We park our kids and governmentally fund programs. We park them in front of a TV to experience an environment where there is harmony across races, gender, indeed species, that doesn't represent anything that we see in America. Why? Why do we do that? It's not realistic. Why do we do that? And yet we don't rail, well, maybe we do rail against PBS for indoctrinating our children about a reality that does not exist. So I'm constantly pushing back on the baseline problem. Why aren't we up in arms railing against Big Bird? Because it's not real. There is no Big Bird, right? And black and white people don't get along. I don't know those communities. They don't exist. And yet we park our kids every day so that they'll play nice with others. And that's what we do to kids all the time. And so it raises these hard questions about where it comes from. So the science is getting to this, but I don't think we have really good data. Like the women, like the gender data is really interesting. Like both men and women have very positive attitudes toward women. So one example where like men have a very strong out-group attitudinal preference. They prefer women more than men. There's other stuff, right? It's connected. Some of it is connected, like Laurie Rudman's work suggests it's connected. A lot of it's connected to the number of like sexual partners you've had. And other kinds of stuff. And even the racial shock the monkey study suggested that the rate at which you lost your fear of the outgroup was mediated by whether you had lots of romantic partners of the outgroup, which would, again, tell a different story about, I guess, very intimate social contact hypothesis. We don't quite know, but people are looking at it, but for, you know, crazy things will happen if the studies find out that early culture will make huge differences, because then, boy, the fight on that is gonna go nuclear.
I have one more question about the application of this knowledge to the general public. So is there a suggestion that you take this and have Mazarin Banaji or Tony Greenwald talk in front of Congress and have them change some laws, or you try to take this information to the public at large to show them that this is still there so maybe they can personally look about or look into debiasing their judgment, or go to the media to show?
in favor of general understanding and kind of individual self-recognition on it. I don't think, so like we've never publicly called for reforming Title VII, right, in the sense that we should change the actual language of Title VII. People have thought about how to rightly interpret Title VII, if you understand Title VII and its interstices, and whether or not intent is a requirement or only causation is a requirement. I think that's a genuinely hard question that no member of Congress ever considered in quite this way. So if you accept that disparate impact is a reasonable doctrinal interpretation of Title VII, and obviously there's a lot of case law that suggests that, if you also accept that none of the science was around when Congress passed Title VII, and if you accept the indeterminacy of text generally, then it's an open question whether implicit bias induced behavioral manifestations ought to lead to a Title VII violation. It doesn't tell you what the remedy ought to be, but it's something that you ought to consider. But we have not yet called for statutory changes. So let me tell you what I and Mazrin, at least, jointly have called for. Let me give the first article was on media. So it's the public interest standard. So in the first big article, which just, you know, which was often described as liberal academic encourages mind control to stop un-PC connections with to keep you from seeing crime, right? That was, and it was very effective. I had to go on, it's rare to go on CNN to talk about a law review article, but I did do it, but. The implications for this was very minor in one sense. All I said is the FCC has to reconsider its definition of public interest because in the massive media ownership ruling in 2003, they operationalized this idea of public interest as competition, diversity, and localism, but the way they got it onto the ground ultimately was the number of hours of local news that a station would show, because local news is local, and diversity, they only wanted to consider nonfiction stuff. They completely ran away from arguments saying, hey, we're showing the Bill Cosby show, give us points for diversity. They did not want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. They just said the number of hours of local news you show. But then it turns out local news is 25% violent crime shows. It is much more similar, at least in LA, it's freeway chases. It's much more similar to cops than anything else, right? And the rate of crime doesn't alter the percentage of crime stories that you actually see. And with studies like Gilliam's that say that if you see this, that you'll have completely expected results, I said, you've got to reconsider why it is you operationalize it as the public interest. That's the only concrete recommendation that I made. But I launched two thought experiments that made people go medieval on me in some sense. The two thought experiments were the following. One was, if you really think of it as a virus, a Trojan horse virus, you look at news because you want the information, you download the news, but on the back end, there might be an exacerbation of some associations. Think about, so we're talking about internet. Think about pornography, right? Step back for a moment. I know this is a public discussion, but maybe you just enjoy it, right? So maybe I'm talking to the men here. Maybe you just enjoy it. And you think, I can't say this publicly, but visual eroticism, there's nothing wrong with it, whether it's hardwired, you just enjoy it, right? What if it turns out, not only do you enjoy it and maybe need it, but on the back end, particular associations between women and subordination actually get strengthened. And even though you resist this and you want equality of the genders, you realize that as you read the data, it's probably likely, certainly within a half hour afterwards, that if you're doing a job talk interview with a female candidate that comes through, that you might not give her a fair evaluation because you just consumed a lot of pornography. You don't want to do it on explicit self-reports. You think it's fair and square. You might have a daughter, and you want her future to be just as equal, right, and capable and all kinds of stuff. But there's the facts, right? So that's the idea. It's a Trojan horse that actually goes into your head, because explicitly you don't want it to have behavioral manifestations. What do you do with Trojan horses? Here are the two thought experiments. You either firewall them or you disinfect. Firewalling would be to actually constrain that stuff going into your head. People would say that's crazy. And then I gave examples. Well, we do it with indecency all the time. Why is the F word going to give you $300,000 of fines, but not the N word? Why don't we go apoplectic about mind control, that the FCC will fine stations $250,000 just because we saw Janet Jackson's nipple? Where's the outrage? What's the social science that says that that will actually lead us to evil people, right? So that's the question about firewalling. It was a thought experiment to suggest that we have implicit biases in the wall. The other one is disinfection. And I said instead of pumping up local news, we should encourage debiasing public service announcements. After 9/11, there was an ad council public service announcement where you had a bunch of people, mostly brown, many of them with accents, who said, "I am an American." They stepped up and said, "I am an American," in their accent over and over again. And for my money, would I rather have people see that on TV and say, "This is our public interest contribution?" Or would I say, "Hey, we showed more crime stories on news"? For my money, it's the debiasing public service announcements, right? That's disinfection. But those were both intentionally phrased as thought experiments. But of course, it's very easy to tweak that as mind control recommending professor to keep you from the truth about how dangerous it is outside. And so this is where, you know, and it's reasonable. I mean, if you read it quickly, you might think, well, that's what I was recommending. But I want to try to suggest, again, an intense conversation on the merits. If you want more details beyond media, there's lots of individual stuff that you could do yourself. You know, there are lots of people who, like, just think about your screensaver. Think about what you make your, you have to fight implicit fire with implicit fire. And so environmentally, it turns out that if you choose not to consume huge amounts of pornography right before an interview, that's a voluntary self-check. I'm totally, it sounds ridiculous because it's so obvious, right? But then why don't we think it's so obvious when it deals with race relations, right? Right? Is it mind control for you to decide, look, I want equality, but I want to see pornography, so I'm going to not see it an hour before the interview. Is that so awful? Is that so violative of your autonomy? One could argue that is actually the best testimony to your autonomy because you're aligning your implicit associations with your explicit commitments, right? And that's what we're trying to push forward.